We're doing the Moon's Lost Light, excuse me, page 49. Let's see. I guess I'll start. And so the students of the Vilna Gaon and other dedicated Jews went to settle in the land of Israel in order to start the redemption. They or their descendants managed to build 50 new neighborhoods in Jerusalem and start a few agricultural settlements in a land that was almost totally barren. But the movement to resettle the land of Israel was eventually taken over by secular Zionism, which had an entirely different goal. They wished to turn the Jewish people into a secular nation defined by its land and its language, but not by its Torah. As Ben Hecht, a secular Zionist spokesman, said about them, they were out to change the Jews from the people of the Torah to the people of Zion, a secular nation. I wonder what 142 is. Should we see that note?
It's a better one at 141.
At 141, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's read 141. Ha'ish al-Chama, part 2, pages 161 to 162, lists the name of the 45 neighborhoods built between 1860 and 1893, 3 years before Herzl convened the first Zionist Congress. Although there was a minority of irreligious settlers, most of the Jews in Eretz Israel at that time were Torah observant. Because the accomplishments of the very religious Jews who preceded the secular Zionist movement are generally not known, I would like to bring here a quote from Avraham Moshe Lunz from his work at Jerusalem in the last 40 years. Quote, "When I pass through the streets of New Jerusalem and see its beautiful and glorious buildings, the large and small neighborhoods crowded and humming with people, the synagogues, the study houses, the elementary yeshivos, and the advanced yeshivos, the benevolent societies which fill them, the neighborhood, the bright-faced and happy youth running to and fro in its streets, and the traffic of life which fills their creation, I remember how it looked 40 years earlier." He writes this in 1869. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Printed in Luach Eretz Yisrael on page 15-19, and in Netivot Zion v'Yerushalayim, and brought in the Ha'ish al-Chama. It is worth noting that Lunz was associated with the secular Zionist movement and so had no reason to exaggerate the accomplishments of the very observant Jews who were the first settlers. There were also agricultural settlements. The first Moshava, Petach Tikva, was built by very religious Jews, as was Rosh Pina, Yesod Hama'ala, Chadera, and others. So interesting to think about that those were the first settlers. Right. It's interesting. I mean, one of the things I think about, I think we talked about the Chalukah system. Right? Did we talk about that a little bit? Chalukah comes from the word chelek, which means part, or in this case, distribution of parts. Mm. Chelek is to pass out parts also. So the Chalukah system was the system of tzedakah used in the land of Israel. And people contributed to the Chalukah. Everybody knew what that was. The Chalukah was what the Jews in Israel, these religious Jews, what they lived on.
Right? That was the guys that went around, the Shlachim, and collected money.
And they collected money, right, for Israel.
But that wasn't the little blue boxes. That was later.
Right.
That was secular Zionists.
Right. All right, secular. And I have a great song for that. Okay. Maybe I'll sing it to you. But anyway, that was the secular Zionists. No, but the Chalukah was for the sake of religious Jews living in the land of Israel. Now, that was a value that all Jews held.
And right? It was collected in the diaspora?
It was collected in the diaspora and sent to Israel because there was no money in Israel. There was no agricultural, basically, I mean, we're talking the 1800s. There's basically very little to no agriculture at all. And there was no industry. There was nothing for people to make money on. So basically, we as a nation understood our collective endeavor of we all yearn somewhere, even if we're not moving there right now, we all yearn to live in Eretz Israel. And we know that it's ours, and we know that Jews should be there, and we all yearn to learn Torah all day long, and most of us can't do that. So we understand the collective Israel, that if we can give to someone to live in the land of Israel and learn Torah all day, we have a part in that, right? So, and the value of Jews living in the land of Israel and learning Torah in the land of Israel, that just like we were talking about with at least knowing Israel advocacy, even if we can't spread it, even if we're not the type that spread it, even the value of us knowing it and us feeling strongly about ourselves does add to the collective strength of Klal Yisrael, that we know deep inside our hearts that Israel is ours and belongs to us. So part of it being ours and belonging to us is having people live there, actually keeping it belonging to us. So the Jews in the diaspora, even the very poor Jews in the Pale of Settlement, would give whatever they could to help support the Jews in Israel, who had nothing to support themselves on. So the Jews in Israel lived in dire poverty, and they were completely supported from outside. As the Jews increased, I just looked this up a little bit yesterday because I was just interested to see. As the Jews increased in population in the land of Israel, and there were more, and it was a little bit harder to collect, they divided them into kololim. Now, I wonder if, I don't know, I wonder if this is maybe the genesis of kololim.
Kolel?
Uh-huh. If they had kolels before that, that they called a kolel, or if this is where they started, but they divided them up into kololim by city, so or region, so that each city, they were hoping that each city, instead of saying, I'm giving to the Jews in Israel,
yeah.
I'm a Volozhiner Jew, I'm yeah. giving to the Volozhiner kolel, wow. so I'm taking care of my own in Israel. So it's a little bit more my own. You know, it's not just my own Jews, but my own city's Jews who are there. So they did that for a while to try to increase a level, a sense of responsibility so that people would give more to support their own city's people.
This is in the mid-1800s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Sir Moses Montefiore was a donor at the time, one of the biggest donors in Jewish history, I think, one of the big names. He was a very frum guy, turns out. It was started out to be a secular religious battle at the time. So he made a pledge to a hospital. They were going to build a hospital. Who doesn't need a hospital? Of course you need a hospital. You get more and more people are coming, and a hospital needs to be there. So he gave a big pledge to the hospital, and then he was contacted by the rabbis of Jerusalem to say, don't you realize, sir, that this hospital is going to be in the hands of the secular Jews, and that they are going to use it just as the Christians use their hospitals to proselytize. The secular Jews are going to use their hospital to proselytize. And you're going to be funding something that's anti-Torah.
Wow.
Yeah, so he withdrew his pledge from the hospital.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. But the battles were hot and heavy at the time. Hot and heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I reading that I've done.
Yeah, I thought about it in the context of Hadassah today, because I am a member of Hadassah, but I do not feel married to their principles at all, and I'm against some of their principles. They're pro-abortion, and they're pro-women's health, but it includes like a lot of things that I'm not, and they're pro-legislation that I don't necessarily agree with, and they use some of their funds to advance that. Not just for the hospital in Israel, so I definitely want to see a hospital there, but they definitely do have an agenda, a political agenda. So when I saw that Hadassah, you know, came out with a statement of full support of the Women of the Wall, I'm thinking, do they have to do that? You don't have to mix that. You look, you know, be Hadassah. But then I noticed when I got the bookmark recently that said on one side what they do in the States and the other side what they do in Israel, so I noticed it's actually interesting. The United States work is all social. As I said, the bowling league.
What?
All social. They have their weekly bowling league, and they have the monthly movie night, and they have the weekly Speak Hebrew, and they have the every other month lunch and learns, and they have... I never really thought about... I mean, I should have, obviously. Just never clicked before that Hadassah is a social organization that also raises funds for Hadassah Hospital and Youth Aliyah. So, but in the States, it's social for the sake of fundraising. But it is a social organization, so they have a social agenda too. Anyway, that's part of the. But Hadassah, I don't know if Hadassah was the answer to that hospital maybe not working or what. I mean, Shari Tzedek. I wonder when Shari Tzedek opened, because that's the religious hospital.
Right.
Lucy Prinzhorn.
Yeah, she worked there. Right, she did. Yeah.
So that goes back to.
Yeah, no, Shari Tzedek is pre-state for sure, but Hadassah is 100 years old. So that was in 1913, I guess, it opened, because they just celebrated 100 years. Maybe it was 1912, maybe it's 101 now. They just celebrated their...
It was this year, I think. It was last year.
This year or last year, that's what I'm saying. So it was either 1912 or 1913. And Shari Tzedek, for sure, was around that time, but was it before? I don't know. And when was it? It would be interesting to know. Did Shari Tzedek open in response to Hadassah, that there should be a religious hospital? Or like, what was the story with that? But anyway, Shari Tzedek is the Shomer Shabbos place. And Hadassah is not. Okay. Secular Zionism really did succeed in building up the land of Israel. making it fruitful and repopulating it with millions of Jews. But Kol HaTor foretold that settling the land of Israel would bring the redemption only if it was done Bo'or Hashem, in the light of Hashem, which he says is the light of Torah. Another note, let's see what that note is. Where'd they all go?
I just see Kol HaTor.
Okay. Since the resettlement of the land of Israel was not done in holiness, it did not bring the redemption. I'll just add in there, yet. Although there are beautiful beautiful religious communities today in the land of Israel, secular Zionism outwardly succeeded in changing large numbers of Jews from the people of the Torah to the people of Zion. The majority of those who came to settle were weaned away from a Torah life in a state whose laws and lifestyle often contradict the Torah's teaching. Much of the state of Israel is now suffering from the same moral and social problems as the rest of Western society whose culture it imitates. As for the Hebrew language, its knowledge is extremely helpful for people who want to use it to study Torah or speak in a way that corresponds to its precepts. But the language is all too often used to express ideas antithetical to the purpose of the Holy Tongue. Mm-hmm. That is
That's
true.
The use of the Yiddish by the Israel religious.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some people specifically will not speak Hebrew because they don't want to use it for mundane activities. Mundane meaning laundry or grocery shopping.
Yeah.
How much more so mundane meaning disco dancing.
Mm, everything else, yeah.
And everything else. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Scientific and technological revolutions. Kol HaTor quotes the statement of the Zohar, and in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, that is to say 5,600 years since creation, or the year 1840 in the secular calendar, the gates of wisdom above and the streams of wisdom below will be opened up, and the world will prepare itself to enter the 7th millennium. What does that remind you of? The gates of heaven, of wisdom above, and the streams of wisdom below?
The Sephiroth? No.
Above and below. What opened above and below?
The waters.
Right, that's right. The waters for the flood of Noah, right? That it came from above and from below, opened from above and created a flood.
Good job.
Yeah, good. And I think that's what it's talking about here. The Zohar then compares this to a person who prepares himself on Friday afternoon for the arrival of Shabbos. 144, okay? In other words, from the period of 1840 onwards, the world will receive a tremendous influx of knowledge in order to prepare itself for its perfected state after the redemption of in the 7,000th year. Kol HaTor states, "So our master, the Vilna Gaon, told us, these are the things that led to the sanctification of God's name in Ikvasa de Mashiach, the building of Jerusalem, the ingathering of the exiles, the flowering of the land of Israel, the perfection of character traits, the revelation of the codes of the Torah, the hidden messages in the Torah, and the study of the seven forms of wisdom." Oh, so this is interesting. Okay, so let's just look back at these.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have... So that's why I alluded to the Noah thing, because it is a flood of knowledge. And think about, we're really in a deluge. You know, it started out as a little trickle in the 1840s, and then they started with trains and clocks and whatever, bits and pieces of things. And now it's like dizzying. Like, you just...
But all these things have come to pass. I mean,
yeah.
You know, perfection of character traits, Musar, revelation of the codes of Torah, that's discovery, that's Aisha's whole thing.
Right, so and the building of Jerusalem we see. In gathering of exiles we see. Right. Flowering the land of Israel we for sure see.
Right.
Perfection of character traits, well, we're not there yet.
But it's become in the public consciousness.
Right.
It's out there.
It's in our
it's
vocabulary.
It's in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But I think we have a ways to go there. The revelation of the codes of the Torah, that is, I mean, Aish was doing that, is doing that. I don't know what the story is with that right now. And the study of the seven forms of wisdom. And let's see, 145, is there a note there? No. Okay, so the seven forms of wisdom are mathematics, formations, and putting together. Perhaps this refers to inventions, because it just that's what it says, just formations.
Let me give you a statistic I heard, I think this morning on the news, that the amount of technology and memory and storage and capability in today's big cell phones is more than they had
in Apollo 11 yeah. that went to the moon.
Way more. Mm. Way more.
Wow. In one little cell phone.
Yeah.
I never thought about the amount of information, the yeah. power, the ability to control and to get and to do things in one cell phone. Then took those guys to the moon.
Yeah, I mean, it used to take yeah. like a computer the size of half the JCC right. to power a cell phone. You know,
I mean, it just
we have in a tiny little chip. It's
thinking
crazy.
About that just blew me away.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah. It is. It's totally amazing.
Yeah, and everybody's got these cell phones now. It's not everybody had an Apollo 11.
Right.
You know, it's really actually the rocket took them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so mathematics, formulations, and putting together. Perhaps this refers to inventions. Medicine and the wisdom of plants. We certainly have that flowering like crazy today.
Sure.
Grammar, correct expression, and composition. That's fascinating, and I wonder what that means.
Yeah.
But we certainly have an explosion of words today also. You know, people are publishing like crazy.
Right, right. Composition for sure.
Yeah. Correct expression is a different question. Grammar, not so much.
It's not.
Correct composition.
Becoming any better.
Not yeah, so much,
yeah,
right?
Grammar is heartbreaking. Even for the people, it used to be your news anchors yeah. that their grammar was very, very good. It
yeah,
was a conscious
anymore.
Thing. So whoever's writing their script now is just next to illiterate. I mean, mine is not good, but I'm so much better than most of them. I just go, who wrote that, and how could you have read that over the air?
Nevertheless.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Number five, music and holiness. That's interesting to put it together. Through correct music, one's soul can attach itself to holiness. The converse is also true. Animalistic music arouses animalistic instincts and unholiness. Interesting. I'll just take a little diversion here today. I listened to a rant that I think people are, I mean, it was a positive rant, I think, but it was sent around as a rant, like, look what this rabbi is saying against Zumba dancing, but really it's against pole dancing. Because apparently a pole dancing studio opened in Brooklyn for from women.
Oh, really?
So he said, when Zumba first started, he said, I didn't say anything. But I should have said something because it's
Zumba
wrong.
Is.
Zumba's kind of like...
it's exercise to a very Latin beat.
Okay.
So it's, okay. But it's not jazzercise.
Okay.
No. It's much more sensual.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it's a Latin beat.
Right.
So a
right.
Latin beat is not a jazzercise class. It's a... But, so it's been made kosher by calling it exercise. You
okay.
break out a real sweat mm-hmm. and you move. But you're moving right. in a very... seductive way. It is a very seductive
but it's just a bunch of women. Where is it up?
And it's very seductive. So he said, when Zumba first came out, I didn't say anything against it, mm-hmm. but I should have then. And he said, and today I am saying Al-Khayt because look what just happened in our own backyard. A dance studio opens up. They have jazzercise, they have Zumba, and they have pole dancing. And they sent out a text saying, hey! And then he didn't say the names, but basically, it's Razi and Shoshana inviting you to our opening night of the dance studio. Come learn hip-hop, Zumba, and pole dancing. For more information, call 1-800-347-POLE. And that's the number that's on their store window. So he said, imagine a mother going to a pole dancing class and then going home and doing her Rashi homework with her kid. He said, what?
Don't compute.
Yeah, does not compute at all. And that's what he's saying. Animalistic music arouses animalistic instincts and unholiness. And he's absolutely right. That, because he said Zumba leads to, and this is what bothered a lot of people, but I totally agree with him. Zumba leads to pole dancing, leads to prostitution. Whether it's prostitution for money or not.
I don't see that path in the firm world, but you know, maybe.
You're,
yeah, I don't see.
Good.
Loosening of morals, maybe.
It definitely loosens it up.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I saw somebody came to visit from Lakewood, Ir HaKodesh. Right, and they do. We call it Lakewood Ir HaKodesh because we live in Denver, Colorado, next to Lakewood, not Ir HaKodesh. Right, so as a joke, we just say Lakewood Ir HaKodesh.
Oh, okay.
But they actually call it Lakewood Ir HaTorah.
Okay.
Right. So a visitor came from Lakewood, and I noticed how she was dressed. She was wearing basically a toothpaste tube cap skirt. I mean, like it was the skinniest little thing. You know, wide at the top and skinny at the bottom, stopped above her knees, standing up. You know, it was so tight. It showed every curve. It was an elastic skirt, so she could move in it.
Right.
But it showed everything. Mm. And standing up, it stopped above her knee. Forget about sitting. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you're from Lakewood, you're Hatorah, and look what, and it's fine. It's like, you're wearing this, and it's fine. No, it's not. That's from Zumba dancing and pole dancing being okay. It's not okay. You're dressing not okay.
Fashion is something that seems to get, setting all that other aside, it seems to me that fashion back east trumps snoot for some reason.
Well, but that's because of this.
Because they're so locked into wanting to appear fashionable in the very, very frum areas.
Yeah, but the fashion are frum fashions. Those are not the fashions on the street. There's a frum fashion.
Yeah, there is a frum fashion, but it seems like the vogue is creeping
yes,
in.
Yes, it
vogue
is.
Vogue is creeping in.
It is, but what I'm saying is it comes yeah. through some of this. It does. If you don't think Zumba makes a difference, not even Zumba, even jazzercise.
If you keep it in your with your husband
no.
and in your bedroom?
No. No, because it changes the way... When you listen to music that's
well,
non-Jewish music...
Very in tune with it.
It definitely makes a difference. And you do break down barriers through music. Mm-hmm. So music can bring you... Can break down spiritual barriers so that you can grow spiritually. And it can break down barriers so that you can deplete yourself. You can deplete yourself spiritually.
You're saying that the manufacturers of clothing for from women are being affected by all this? Because that's who's manufacturing clothing?
Yeah.
People who want to make a sale.
Right.
So the manufacturers of clothing.
Manufacturers of clothing and the women who are buying it. You're only selling what people are going to buy. Like, for instance, shells.
If it's out there, people are going to buy it.
Well, for instance, shells, right? Mm-hmm. So shells have gotten higher and higher over the last few years. They started out with Linda Leal's 10 years ago that kind of went to here, and they got to the choking level, right? So now they're all choky. Some literally you can't wear them. They choke you. Yeah, they're very tight. Yeah. So shells. But now there's a modern Orthodox shell. You could still buy a Kiki Riki that's got a modern neckline. You know, so now you could breathe in it. It's lower than, you know, the women in the Haredi world would wear. But it's still not down to here. Like, you can buy something that's a little comfortable that's right here that you can still put under something if you want a shell, but with a modern neckline. So it's definitely consumer-driven. That's the point. How high the necklines went was consumer-driven, and how now the fact that there's two lines, necklines, is consumer-driven. So it's not just the manufacturers are manufacturing that they're listening to a Latin beat while they're designing clothes. It's that they're designing clothes that people want to buy.
Right, right.
Wait, when you say that the shell went up, it means that there's a manufacturer that makes shell that's sold in frum stores?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
So it's not like, you know, you would just go to any store.
No.
Frum clothing in online.
Oh.
Or Shell Shelly. My daughter's store is Shell Shelly.
Okay.
So she sells Linda Leals and Kiki Rikis. So and they don't sell the modern line.
Oh,
they
okay.
only sell the first ones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so that's music. Music and holiness going together. And number six, the wisdom of repair and integration. So whatever that means. Let me read number seven, the wisdom of how the physical connects with the spiritual. So she's saying here psychology, but it could be more than that. I just want to say what Rabbi Sachs says, which I like very much, when he talks about religion and science being partners.
Mm-hmm.
So he said they're different studies. Science is disassembling things to see how they work. Religion is assembling things to see what they mean.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, let's do that one.
Science is disassembling things to see how they work. And religion is integrating things, assembling things to see what they mean. So I was thinking about that here in number seven. Well, in number six and number seven, the wisdom of repair and integration. Right.
Okay, and then religion. I'm very slow today. Religion is what was that?
Reassembling.
Not reassembling. Just assembling.
Assembling.
Just assembling things.
Okay.
To see what they mean.
To see what they mean.
Right. So it's two.
I looked him
complementary
up on the internet,
pathways.
By the way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It looks very, very.
Yeah. Two complementary pathways.
Dr. Sachs.
He does not see them as separate. They're separate studies, but they're not opposing at all. They're complementary pathways that are looking at different things.
Who said this?
Jonathan Sacks.
Look him up on the net.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's no longer, like you say, the head of...
He's no longer the chief rabbi. He stepped down.
He's the one because he's doing...
But he's still Lord Rabbi Doctor.
Yeah, okay. That's true. Yeah. It says Lord
Rabbi. Lord
it's,
Rabbi
it's
Doctor.
Yeah.
He has a PhD in philosophy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, these forms of wisdom, says Kol HaTor, were all made known to Yosef, who was taught by an angel before he stood before Paro. Mm. And they are all connected to the task of his heir, Mashiach ben Yosef. 147.
That's a very fascinating subject that's not addressed very much openly.
Right.
In Mashiach ben Yosef?
Right. Okay, note 147. Yeah. The first one to merit heavenly Bina and Chachma was Yosef the Tzaddik, about whom it is written, an understanding and wise man. And from him is drawn the great mission of Mashiach ben Yosef in all the generations. And all the more so in the end of Ikvos Mashiach. And on page 125 it says, and so it happens that on the night before the day of Yosef's release from prison, he reached the 70 languages through the angel Gabriel and the 7 wisdoms through the angel, whatever that is. Yeah, so I guess if she wrote it that way, it's probably because we don't pronounce the name of that angel. And that's the first basis for the revelation of the secrets of the Torah by Mashiach ben Yosef in the Ikvos Mashiach.
Who wrote Ikvos Mashiach?
No, Ikvos Mashiach is Mashiach. The day, the footsteps of the Messiah.
Oh, the footsteps of the Messiah. Uh-huh.
And here she's just quoting from the book Kol HaTor. Okay. Kol HaTor.
Tanya got through this book before she left. She was enthralled.
Kol HaTor continues. And why should we leave this great property of our holy Torah, or part of it, to others, and the name of heaven will be desecrated, and the disgrace to the Torah will become great? 150. Where is that? Mm-hmm. Oh, we missed a note. So did I skip a page?
149.
You read 147.
We didn't do 149.
Oh, okay, fine. I'll read 149. Okay. The basis... Okay, this is also from Kol HaTor, page 118. The basic of basics of all creation, all the upper and lower worlds, and all which are in them, is the light of the upper wisdom, and the wisdom of God and the holiness above. And they are all in the Torah in holy codes, and their sparks descend from above to below until the world of practical action and become materialized in the lower world, which are the 7 wisdoms which are included in the 7 pillars of the world, as is known. And in order to understand and grasp the wisdom of the Torah, which is included in the upper light of wisdom, it is necessary to learn also the 7 wisdoms which are hidden in the lower world of nature. Okay, so that's very esoteric, but basically, the more we know, the better off we are, as long as it's in the kosher realms.
Well, and the more we know, the more we know we don't know.
Right, but the point is, there is such a thing to study mathematics, for instance, because the more we expand our minds through that, the more Torah we can hold. So that's what it's saying here.
You know, I'm reminded of the whole, worldview of the Greeks, who really put this ahead of everything, but with no spirituality at all.
Right.
Yes.
Right, so that's why Yafet is supposed to dwell in the tents of shame. Mm-hmm. Right, that they do have that, but they need to put it in the right context. And so as long as they're still out of context, we still reject what they thought. But that there should be wisdom of math and music and inventions, science, that's all vital within the tent of shame.
So that being said, and I know where this is leading, obviously, you know, you have to take all this and combine it with Torah to get a complete understanding of the world. However, there are students in Israel now, and children, that do not learn English, do not learn any secular subjects at all. It's just all Torah.
Right.
So what's going on there?
I would say out of balanceness.
Mm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You have children in this country also.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, say Macha Shalom. Yeah. We need that Shalom.
No secular education.
Yeah, I know.
Mainly boys.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, the question is really, what do we need? So, we do have, I guess, end holders. In a way, that's what Rabbi Avi Weiss wants to be, is somebody who puts a peg on the left and holds it tight. And we have people with pegs on the right who hold it tight. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them is going to make it into the future. Mm. You know, it is a balance. It's going to make it somewhere. But neither one of them over time will be what stays. And we'll see over time. Mm-hmm. And both of them feel they're totally right this very moment. You know, but really, it is a question. What's going to happen with all those people who are pulling so much to the right and to the right into an unhealthy place of not being able to sustain themselves financially? That's why I looked up the Chalukah system, mm-hmm. because that's not the system that we have today. Right, the Chalukah system was a voluntary system where I said, I appreciate your work and your learning, and therefore I will take from my pocket to put into your mouth, right? So that's not the system of today. The system of today is, I go to work, I get taxed, and part of my tax dollar goes to support you.
Who studies all
day? Who chooses not to work.
Yeah.
So it's not voluntary. I'm not saying I think your studying's gorgeous. In fact, I feel stolen from. So,
this is your personal feeling.
No.
No, you're talking about in Israel.
Oh, in Israel.
In Israel. That's what's going on.
Yeah. But how do you feel about that?
I don't think it should be taxes. I think it should be tzedakah. I think it should be choice.
Yeah.
That, I mean, we could get to a place where I believe that B'nai Torah, first of all, you're supposed to work. The Chavetz Chaim worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't have personal wealth, the Rambam worked.
Right.
If you don't have personal wealth or you don't have a personal deal, Rambam had a personal deal with his brother.
His brother.
And that's right.
And Issachar.
But he was
right.
also
right.
one of the most enlightened men in that.
Right.
But the point is, my personal opinion is that's how it should work.
Yeah.
Right. I believe that either you have the bracha from Hashem of enough money that you don't have to work, whether you inherited it or whatever, you found it, whatever it is, you have that bracha, and so you don't need to work. So then, great, spend all your time learning. Or you need to earn enough to support yourself and your family and learn as much as you can. Learning is a top priority. And a reason to stop learning, to take a break in learning, whether it's in the day or in your lifetime, you're supposed to always learn, you know, a certain amount, but is because you have to earn an income. And maybe because you have to go to school to earn an income. So maybe you're not going to learn full-time because you're going to med school. You're going to go to med school, you'll become a doctor. And once you become a successful doctor in 15 years, you're going to be able to work half-time if you have been careful to not live within all your means and put some money aside and live on less than what you earn. Then you won't have made yourself a standard of living that you can't maintain by working half-time for the rest of your life. And you can learn half-time, half a day, every day for the rest of your life. That's what I think should be, is that we should be earning and learning. Or, let's say you're a particular genius. Somebody should look at you and say, you are so special, I want the merit of supporting you in learning. Mm-hmm. So that you've shone your light so brightly into somebody else's realm that they say, I want to pick up the tab for your learning and share with me. I'll share with you my income and you share with me your zchus. Right? So that's what it should be. It should not be that people are forced through their taxes to fork over money that they don't actually want to people who aren't actually shining brightly enough to get somebody to give it to them voluntarily. So that's my personal opinion. Right, okay. So we'll see what happens. Things are unraveling now.
We create a welfare right. state.
Yeah, we've created.
In Israel, there is an awakening. I'm told by someone who lives there that I get to talk with often that it's not huge, but it's there. The undercurrent of the non-religious saying, well, what does it really mean to be a Jew? So I say I'm a Jew and I live in Israel. What's this all about to be a Jew? And so they put their toe in the water of understanding what the Torah is.
But they should have been learning this all along.
Oh, I know, but no, they're secular.
They didn't.
They're totally secular.
No, you don't understand. It's more than
you're
secular.
You're living in a Jewish state. Yeah.
Well, however,
you're not living in a Jewish state.
Right.
Well, it should have been a Jewish state.
Right, yeah. Right. It should have, and that's the problem.
When you think
See,
that.
Secular here in this country is just plain old par of ignorant.
Right.
secular in Israel is anti-Torah, yeah. anti-Jewish.
Right, has been. Has
yeah.
been.
So now the anti-sentiment has gone the way of the pro-Zionist sentiment, which is, that's for the old people. So now you first have power of ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, of people who are able to say, I'm curious, instead of right. saying, keep me away from that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the beginning. Yeah. But you do have this resentment and anger still between yes. the secular and the religious,
right.
largely because of this financial, the financial piece,
the
this army, the army yes. service yeah. piece, and the financial piece.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Beryl Wine wrote about it last week,
oh.
or the week before. He wrote a great piece.
Mm,
said, you know, a young Haredi child went to his father and asked him about the Hanukkah story. And his father said, well, the yeshiva Bachram took time off to fight a war. They were soldiers wearing black and white. And their goal was to establish a Jewish state, but not a Zionist one. What? And it's just like, it's to show like how far have we come that like mm-hmm. Haredim cannot identify with the Maccabees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they fought a war, they yeah. were soldiers.
Yes.
They stopped learning so they could fight. And it was to establish a Jewish state. Right. So so he said, look, we're basically fighting last century's battles. And every time somebody fights against the religious, they think that they're being attacked for being religious, when in fact they're not. If somebody wants to decrease the subsidies to large families, it's not that Judaism is being attacked. It's that people are tired of supporting people who are not working. Go and get a job. So he said, and it's surprising that he wrote this.
Wow.
And so he said somebody came to him to get instruction on how to go to the States and raise money. He had a lot of debts because he hasn't been working. So he wants to go and, you know, raise some money to pay his debts. So Rabbi Wein said to him, you have a degree as an engineer. Maybe it would be easier for you to get a job and earn that money.
Over here. Yeah.
And he said, well, I have daughters to marry off, and the kind of husbands they're looking for would not accept a father who's working.
Yeah. Isn't that
so instead,
so
he'll go to the States and go door to door and ask for money, because that is a kosher way to take from other people who are engaged in the tarfus of working. And take
sounds
their money.
Sounds a little okay, like our political situation
so,
today.
Right, it's so it's a bad, we're in a bad situation. So it's going to change. It will change because that system has to collapse.
Right.
So, and then those people who have prepared themselves through learning and keeping Torah and earning. It's interesting because I spoke with my teacher yesterday, one of my teachers. I won't say his name because he probably would rather I don't quote him, but whoever knows him knows him. So he said when he was being raised, his parents were American-born but very frum, and they sent him to yeshivas, and he didn't get much of a secular education initially. But he was told, I mean, his track at that time was go to college, be frum, earn an income, learn a lot of Torah, both to prove to our secular family members that you can be frum and educated, both, and you can do it, and you be the beacon of light in the family. He said, and now today, he has grandchildren who don't do that, but he feels like now today the voice is go to college and be frum so you can prove to our frum family members that you can do both.
Mm-hmm.
So first it was to prove to the Frey family members that you can do both, and now it's to prove to the frum family members that you can do both.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Where does one find this talk, this?
Yeah, where did Beryl Wine write
this? I'll try to mail it to you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, probably. It was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'll try to email it.
Okay.
Because I thought what was interesting, I'll send you another article that Jonathan Rosenblum wrote, which I thought was fascinating.
Okay.
I think he probably wrote it because of the Beryl Wine piece. Last week, he praised somebody who's working. Somebody who was in Kiruv and doing great work, and then needed to earn more money than that for his family, and so he went into Shechita. And he learned the laws and art of kosher animal slaughter, and now his hands are deep in the animals, bloody all day long, but he earns a paycheck, and he brings it home, and he gives it to his wife, and she spends it, and the family is supported. And the kedusha that's generated through earning an income and giving it to your wife to spend.
Oh, Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking, like, Mashiach must be really close.
Gotta be around the corner. I keep saying it's not noon yet. You know, he could still come forward today.
Right. We'll hop to it. Let's
2 o'clock.
Go.
He can still come forward.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. We have one more minute or two more.
Yeah.
Where are we?
149. This is your wisdom and your understanding.
Okay.
Your
I didn't get
that. Nations.
Okay. Note 149? Yeah, we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our rabbi, the holy God of Israel, our master, Eliyahu, also busied himself a great deal with scientific investigations for the purpose of grasping the wisdom of the Torah and for the purpose of making a Kiddush Hashem in the eyes of the nations and for the sake of hastening the redemption. From his youth did he wondrously in all the seven wisdoms, and he requested very much and even commanded his students to learn as much as possible these seven wisdoms of the investigation of earth, to raise the wisdom of Israel according to the wisdom of the Torah in the eyes of the nations. And on page 118 he writes, who can tell and who can imagine the great concern of our rabbi for raising the banner of Torah and its students amongst the masses of the entire house of Israel? Where is the writer and where is the one who can measure and describe his great concern for making a Kiddush Hashem in the eyes of the nations? Many times he would say, sighing heavily, why should the nations say, where is the wisdom of Israel? And on page 122, in every generation there are individuals in Israel from amongst the Torah scholars who have made important scientific discoveries with great wisdom. He also says that many discoveries which were afterwards attributed to non-Jews were actually discovered by Jewish Torah scholars. But to our great sorrow, most of the Torah scholars have left scientific research, which is all included and encoded in the wisdom of our Holy Torah. This despite God's desire for our Torah, i.e. for our scientific studies done as part of Torah. But which is said, for it is your wisdom and understanding in the eyes of the nations. So it's interesting because here he says it's so sad that the Torah scholars have left scientific discoveries, mm-hmm. but it's also sad that our scientists have left Torah. Right? That we have, and I definitely think that this is a Christian problem, that we have absorbed the dichotomy of science and Torah, you know, and saying that you have to do one or the other. And it's not our thing. Judaism has it all integrated. And we Jews have separated it out. We've allowed the narishkeit of the nations to fold into us, and people have bought the line that Torah and science don't go together. They
right.
totally do.
Right. Belief in God and science don't, right. don't go together in the Christian world.
Right. right. So, but in Judaism, they do. And so we just have to get back to the integration of it. But part of the challenge of the integration is people, some people on the very right who behave in foolish ways, behave in ways that aren't pleasant. So who would want that Torah? But also behave in ways that paint themselves into corners so that, you know, it's difficult to see how it could blend. But it definitely does. So an integrated, healthy... So I hope that what's going to happen is that as we plow forward as... I mean, we should all be married. We should all be zochet to be integrated, healthy Jews. We should plow forward in our pursuit of many wisdoms, b'shem Hashem, l'shem shamayim, so that we will create a community of people who are integrated and excited, generating Torah wisdom and elevating the name of Jews in Torah, and for the sake of elevating the name of Hashem in the world through our contributions, scientifically and spiritually.
Well, what's interesting is that all these great men, and most of them, had very similar opinions to this, how certain of their teachings are taught openly, and others are just pushed aside, such as this.
Right.
So talk about picking and choosing.
Absolutely.
One from column A and two from column B.
Right. So there's a ton of picking and choosing going on for the sake of political correctness. And we're in a politically correct... a poisonous place.
Yes.
Poison political correctness.
Right. Whether it be the secular world or whether it be the Jewish world.
Right, right.
Yes.
So.
But, you know, I don't want to say that sometimes these things are mutually exclusive, but it is very, very hard to be observant and to be able to sustain the pace and the demand that business world expects you to.
Yes.
You know, now more than in the last century, you know.
You're right.
Because we're not talking about just, you know, being an owner of a store.
Store.
Right.
Where you can just close and go home and do whatever, you know. Through all these years that I worked with, well, in NASA, I saw just two Orthodox men working as engineers, and they would try to find time, and they would have lunch break, and I would see that they're doing their chavrusa, you know. Mm-hmm. But they were just, you know, two.
Right.
And, yeah. So.
Right. You're absolutely correct, and that is one of the brachos that we will bring to the world, is balance. We are out of balance, right? And I think I mentioned in this group before, I heard on at night, they have the British news on NPR. So they had, you know, an invention in 60 seconds. You had 60 seconds to say what you would invent if you could. So this person said what they would invent if they could is a cell phone sensor that it would sense your hand, whether it's sweat level, or sense your anxiety level, and shut your phone down if you were stressed. Just like your inbox it says you're full, right? So they could sense if you're full. If you're on information overload, your phone would shut down automatically so that no more information can come in until you can reboot, right, yourself. So, and she would just make it axiomatic. Like, it's just not a choice. You can't override that function. Right. It just shuts down so that you have a chance to clear your mind and think a little bit before you have continue with the information input. And it just has to be an axiomatic thing. Mm. And I'm thinking, we have that. It's called Shabbos. Mm-hmm. You know, once a week, we cut everything off. You know, and it's a reboot, and we have it built into our lives. So, but you're right, the pace today is zoom, zoom, zoom all the time and don't sleep at all, and you might as well get medicated so that you can sleep less.
But you know, I can, you know, I almost wanted to say that, you know, it's either, even for me, you know, I'm trying, when I'm at home, I can do my best, you know, in keeping shovels, doing things that I would, you know, not be able to do when I'm on the road.
Right.
It's like I get transported in a totally different, different world when I'm not here. You know, I get, like, it's just...
Right. Right, so that's part of the avoda, is pulling that back, right? It's pulling it down.
I have to be at work. I can't just, you know, I'm the only one there who is working with both sides. So I have to be there, and it's Shabbos. And I know that I'm, you know, it's either I quit and just completely rethink what I'm doing with my life.
Or, which some people, you know, do. Or sometimes...
Yes, I'm, and I'm not saying that, you know...
Or sometimes they'll accommodate. Sometimes they accommodate. You know, I mean, my husband's a Shomer Shabbos attorney, and there would be times when 3 o'clock on a Friday, he would look at the judge and say, I have until 3:30, and then I have to leave. And the judge knew it. It just wasn't an option. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter where they were holding and whatever the proceeding was. At that time, it was time to close the door and go home, no matter where they're holding. So it might be easier in New York than in Colorado. I don't know exactly. But I imagine that even in Colorado, because we do have laws in this country to protect that, that one can say, you don't say that at 3:15, you know, that you have to leave at 3:30. But you say it at 8 a.m. or you say it on Monday that at 3:30 on Friday, you're out of there. And then you just have to plan around it. And that's all there is to it. And people can. It's actually possible to plan around Shabbos.
You know, it's all my fault. I'm not blaming
it. No, I'm saying the workplace too. They can. I'm not blaming. I'm just saying it's possible that they could do that.
It's
possible that at some point, yes.
It's hard.
Hard for sure.
Yes.
And possible. But that is part of the gift that we bring, is helping people understand, you know what? You do not have to be working 24/7 to make the world function. 24/6 is enough. Yeah. You know? So, possibly even 8-6 or 8-5.
I'm so glad I'm from the generation, really, that I'm from, because I enjoy my cell phone, and I like the protection that I feel like I have when I'm out by myself, which is often. But I didn't even bring it today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I refuse to be tied to that phone. Because I tell my children when they say, Mother, even if you bring it with you, you don't answer it at the time, and you don't have it turned on. I leave it in the car when I'm in shopping. I said, when I'm out, I'm out.
Right.
So it's a privilege if you can get a hold of me when I'm out. So I'm glad I'm from the generation that I can do that.
You can do that.
Yes, absolutely.
Not everybody can.
Not everybody can. They choose not to.
That's true.
That's another choice thing.
Yeah. Well, I think we just made a little choice with the FAA to not allow cell phone conversations on planes. There was enough consumer backlash to say, could there be one place on the planet where you can't talk on your cell phone? Yeah.
Well, so we did make a choice. But the only people who were for